Okay, so first of all, let me thank the organizers for this opportunity. The title of my talk is Entanglement Dynamics Following Quantum Quenches, and I'll study this entanglement dynamics in two different systems. Most of the talk will be focusing on quenches involving flow K churn insulators, and then towards the end, I will talk a little bit about quenches in 3D critical systems. And I should highlight that the entire work here has been done by the following two people: Daniel Yates, who's a PhD student, and Yona Lemonik, who's a postdoc at NYU. And I would encourage you to stop and ask questions rather than holding it to the end. Okay, so in a quantum quench, what you essentially do, you start with a many-particle system, which is, say, the ground state of some Hamiltonian HI, and then you study unitary time evolution under the influence of another Hamiltonian HF. And for the purposes of this talk, I'll be interested in a situation where HI and HF are very different. So in the first case, I'll consider HI to have no topological order of any kind. In particular, I'll be looking at, for example, ground state of half-filled graphene. But the time evolution will be with respect to a Hamiltonian that can support topological order. And so then the interesting question is, how does topological order grow in time? What are the signatures of that on entanglement entropy and entanglement spectrum? And then the second part of the talk will be one where the initial Hamiltonian is magnetically disordered, but the time evolution is with respect to a Hamiltonian which can support long-range order. And in particular, I'll look at the case where the parameters of the quench are such that the system is tuned to be near a critical point. And so we know that in equilibrium, critical points are associated with all kinds of universal behavior. So what is the signature of universality on time evolution? And again, you can ask the same questions. What is the signature of universality on entanglement statistics? And so I'll always be interested in bipartite entanglement. So imagine I take a full system, and it's always ideal, closed, there's no coupling to an external reservoir, and I split it into two parts, A and B, and I'll always do this split in real space. And I'll construct a reduced density matrix of the subsystem A obtained by taking a trace over the subsystem B. So we've heard this many times, and I don't have to tell you why studying the entanglement entropy or spectrum is interesting. I mean, it's like preaching to the choir. This slide everybody's familiar with. If I have a wave function which is constructed out of the ground state of a Hamiltonian with short-range interactions, and there is a gap, we all know that this entanglement entropy associated with this subsystem A shows area loss scaling. If I take an arbitrary excited state of such a Hamiltonian, it shows volume loss scaling. And then we've heard many times in this conference that one of the characteristics of a many-body localized state is that if you take any arbitrary excited state, even that shows area loss scaling, and that's consistent with the fact that the system does not thermalize. The outer region B doesn't act like a very efficient reservoir for the inner region A. Again, a reminder why entanglement statistics is interesting. There are already some very nice papers that tell you that it's very important from the point for studying topological order. So let's say that my wave function is the ground state of some topological Hamiltonian, but I've introduced periodic boundary conditions, so there's no edge states in the real system. However, if you put an entanglement cut, then the bulk boundary correspondence that you know exists in real space also extends to the entanglement spectrum, and in particular, the entanglement spectra shows certain host edge states. This is again a rather well-studied topic, and I will come back to this in a couple of slides. But since I'm talking about quenches, I want to also remind you of these very classic results by John Cardi and Pasquale Calabrese from 2007. What happens to the entanglement entropy when I do a quench? So these results were obtained in 1D. So imagine that I cut the system into two parts again. Let's introduce periodic boundary conditions on a ring, and let me look at the entanglement entropy of this subsystem A. Let's say initially the system is in the ground state of some Hamiltonian with short-range interactions, and there's a gap. Then we know that initially the entanglement entropy will have some very small number value, which will show area loss scaling. Because the correlations are all decaying within a few lattice sites. So all the entanglement is entirely at the boundaries. But now let's say I do a quench, then quite generically what the quench does is that it creates an excited population of quasi-particle pairs. So these quasi-particle pairs, you can think of them as EPR pairs, where one member of the pair is moving to the left with velocity v, another member of the pair is moving to the right with velocity minus v. And so whenever a member of the pair leaves region A and enters into region B, the entanglement entropy increases. So with this simple semi-classical picture, you can therefore argue that the entanglement entropy will keep increasing linearly in time with a rate, which is given by the velocity of these ballistically propagating quasi-particles. And then, can I finish my sentence? Yes. OK, so just one second. So it'll keep increasing linearly with the rate, which is given by the velocity of these ballistically propagating quasi-particles. And then it'll saturate at a time t equal to L over 2v. This is the time at which the pair which was emitted furthest from the boundary ends up going into the other region. And it saturates to a value which is the a volume law with the prefactor determined by the density of quasi-particles that have been emitted due to the quench. Yes, your question?
From your argument, it seems that if I can just consider classical Boltzmann gas and mutual information, this should go.
Yeah, this can be. Yeah, I mean, yes, the quantumness is just coming from the initial, by assuming the initial state is this kn minus k. And so every time, so you count your entropy in that way, that every time one member of the pair goes, crosses into region A and goes into region B, the entropy increases, yes. But otherwise, the growth itself is completely semi-classical. And I will show you that actually much of this picture also can explain the entanglement dynamics in 2D and 3D. Okay. So what am I going to talk about? Well, the first part of the talk will be quenches in spatial dimension D equal to 2. So here I'll start with ground state of half-filled graphene, and then I'll study the time evolution due to the switch-on of a periodic circularly polarized laser. We've already heard several times in this conference that this is a graphene with a circularly polarized laser gives you a flow catcher and insulator. And so what are the signature of edge states in the entanglement spectrum and so on and so forth? And the second part of the talk, so while the first part of the talk has no interactions in it, it's free fermions, the second part of the talks will have interactions because I'll consider phi to the 4 type theory. And then it's not exactly solvable, but I'll show you that in the large n limit, there are again some exact solutions available for us. So we can make some predictions for how the entanglement entropy and spectra behave. For the second case. So first part of the talk. So let me remind you about Chern insulators. This is the famous model by Duncan Haldane, proposed in 1988. It's a way to get quantum Hall physics without application of an external magnetic field. You still break time reversal, and the way time reversal is broken is by introducing a staggered magnetic flux. So when it was first proposed, it seemed like a very artificial model. Basically, if you take a plaquette, there's no net magnetic field here. But if you take look at these little triangles here, they enclose some flux. So there's positive flux in this triangle, negative flux in this triangle, so that the total flux cancels. And this model allows for next nearest neighbor hopping of electrons, so that if I take a path which is going in the clockwise direction, it picks up a phase. As opposed to a path going in the anti-clockwise direction, which will pick up a different phase. So that's how you break time reversal in this problem. And then when you work out the bands, indeed you have a valence band and a conduction band with Chern number 1 and minus 1 respectively. And if you put a boundary, the bulk boundary correspondence immediately shows up as the appearance of chiral edge states at the boundary. So when this model was introduced, it was thought to be very artificial. But by now, we know that this can actually be realized in experiments. And this was done in Tilman Esslinger's group in 2014. So basically, you just take graphene, and you apply a circularly polarized laser. So when you apply any periodic drive, what happens is that even if originally without the drive you had just hopping between nearest neighbor sites, the periodic drive can give you matrix elements for hopping to next nearest neighbor sites and next nearest neighbor sites, next to next nearest neighbor sites. Moreover, the circular polarization ensures that trajectories which are going clockwise versus those that are going anti-clockwise do not pick up the same phase. So that's how you break time reversal using a circularly polarized laser. And in the high frequency limit, indeed, you find that there is a effective time independent Hamiltonian, the so-called Floki Hamiltonian, which is identical to the Haldane model. So if this is the band structure of graphene, then in the presence, then the high frequency limit of this laser, this model, the bands look like this. There's an opening up of a gap, and this was an analog of this has already been seen in experiments that Nogedic talked about, right? There was a time reversal symmetry broken gap opening of Dirac fermions on the surface of 3D topological insulator. Okay, but if all you are doing with a periodic laser or periodic drive is just mimicking some static Hamiltonian, then I don't think it's very interesting. And so this slide is just to summarize why periodic drive is essentially different from just a static Hamiltonian. So on the left-hand side is an example of a static churn insulator like the Haldane model. So energy is conserved. The band has a minimum and a maximum. You have two bands, a conduction band. You have two bands, a conduction band and a valence band of churn number 1 and minus 1, respectively. And so there has to be a chiral edge mode, which comes out from the bottom of the top band and smoothly connects up with the top of the bottom band. But if I'm talking about a periodically driven system, then energy is not a conserved quantity. Energy is not conserved up to integer multiples of the driving frequency. So what's happening on the y-axis is actually just is not the true energy, but the quasi-energy spectrum, right? So it's the analog of the quasi-momentum that you tend to draw when you have a periodic crystal, where momentum is not conserved up to a crystal momentum. So now if I give you a set of bands which have churn number 1 and minus 1, there you are in a conundrum because there's no unique way to draw chiral edge modes. You could draw it like this, but you could also draw it in a way that it comes out from the top of the upper band and smoothly connects to the bottom of the lower band. So the churn number by itself doesn't uniquely tell you how the edge states are arranged. And as Mark was saying, you need another topological invariant. And the origin of this talk of topological invariant comes from the fact that you have actually not only periodicity in kx and ky, you have periodicity in time. And so there are other topological invariants that you can write down that correctly tells you precisely how many edge modes you have at any given quasi-energy. But the point I want to make is that when you have a periodic drive, the structure of the edge states become remarkably different. And this is an example of four different phases in graphene under the effect of a circularly polarized laser. So this one here is a lot like the Haldane model. It's obtained at a frequency which is fairly high. And by high frequencies, I mean frequency larger than the bandwidth of graphene. So I'm really talking about some experiments with cold atoms, because bandwidth of graphene in a true graphene is 6 electron volts. And so you can't really do it in a solid state system. So this is a high frequency. This is the high frequency phase. It looks like the conventional Haldane model with two bands with churn number 1 and minus 1 and regular dispersing chiral edge modes through the center of the band. This one, on the other hand, is a very interesting phase. It's when the frequency of the laser is actually slightly smaller than the bandwidth. And so what is happening is that it is bringing various parts of the graphene lattice in resonance. And it's not a particularly high amplitude laser. Just the moment that it's resonant, what you're doing is you're causing all kinds of interesting topological phase transitions, because in a rotating wave approximation, you can imagine that you're moving parts of the conduction band through the valence band because of the resonant coupling. And so what happens is that this resonant coupling changes the churn number of the resultant band, giving you a much larger churn number of 3. And as the churn number increases from 1 to 3, you introduce additional edge modes. So you introduce 3 edge modes. But remember that this is a periodically driven system, so you have to think these 3 edge modes do not actually appear in a conventional way. Conventional edge modes would be that all the 3 are traveling in the same direction on one edge of the cylinder. But in this case, what happens is there is one edge mode, and the other 2 edge modes are counterpropagating to it. So these 2 counterpropagating edge modes are sitting in the Floki zone boundaries. And this one, the solid line, is the edge mode which is sitting in the center of the Floki zone boundary. Okay? So again, there's no unique way to do it. And in this case, the way it appears is because of the resonant process, these two additional edge modes are appearing at the flow k-zone boundaries. And this one, which is at the center of the flow k-zone boundary, can be thought of as linked to this one. And as you're reducing the frequency, you're just generating more edge states and going through various topological phase transitions. Then you have other kind of interesting possibilities here. For example, this is a you can also have churn number zero, also discussed by Mark. But then here, churn number zero, again, there are many ways you can get zero churn number. And in this particular case, you get them by having equal number of chiral edge modes above the band and below the band. And then this is a phase which is actually low frequency but high amplitude, and it ends up looking very similar to the Haldane model, except that I will show you through the entanglement spectrum that they're very different. Because they create very different bulk excitations. So I'll come to that. So before I go to the topic of how the entanglement spectrum looks, let me ask, everybody asks this question, how are these states actually occupied? Because it's not a system which is in equilibrium. And of course, I can always write down all kinds of churn numbers and topological invariants, but what do they even mean if we don't even know how these bands are occupied? So here is a example of how these bands could be occupied, where these dark circles here represent the size of the circles. It tells you the population of these bands. And essentially what we did here is we just studied unitary time evolution from half-filled graphene under the application of a circularly polarized laser. And so there are infinite number of conserved quantities in the problem which determine the occupation probability of these levels. They are simply the overlap of the exact wave function of the periodically driven system with the initial state. So mod square of that overlap is precisely what's plotted here. So the one thing I want you to note is that this is the high frequency laser case where I've done something very terrible. I've switched on the laser as a quench. And yet you can see that the occupation is really very close to a effectively zero temperature state. And that's entirely because the laser is highly off-resonant. The quench does produce some bulk excitations, but not too many. And these edge states are really kind of very nicely occupied at an effective, very low effective temperature. But on the other hand, if you take the resonant laser into account, this is the case of churn number three. So you have one set of edge modes that are sitting here, and the other two edge modes are sitting in the flow k-zone boundaries. Then you can see that this is an example of classic resonance physics, right? So what the laser does is that it resonantly couples these two regions of the band, and so there is a huge population transfer from the lower to the upper band. And moreover, these edge modes, which are not very well visible here because the band gap is very small, are occupied at a fairly high effective temperature. In contrast, the edge modes that were kind of adiabatically linked to these edges are still occupied at a very low effective temperature. So the long story short is that you are introducing additional edge states, but not all of them are behaving in the same way. The ones that are coming from the off-resonant processes are still occupied at a fairly low effective temperature, whereas the ones that are arising due to resonant processes are occupied at a very high effective temperature. And by the time you come to this phase, which has very high amplitude and low frequency laser, it's almost like an infinite temperature state where all the levels are almost uniformly occupied. So we also looked at the things like just DC conductivity, where you can kind of do a Kubo formula derivation for sigma xy, and you can show that's equal to, integral over the Brillouin zone of the Berry curvature integrated over one period of the laser, but weighted by the occupation of these bands. And so we do this exercise by taking the occupation probability coming from, for example, the quench, And you will get exactly C squared over H if one band is completely occupied and the other is completely empty. This is a lot like the formula you would write down for Anomalous Hall effect, except that because it's a time-dependent system, the Berry curvature is varying in time. So if you carefully do the calculation, you'll find that the DC conductivity actually is related to some time average of the Berry curvature rather than just the Berry curvature at any given time. And essentially, what one sees when one does the Hall conductivity is that high-frequency laser, so what's plotted here is the Chern number, and the sigma xy would follow the Chern number exactly if I had an exact occupation of the flow k bands. But because I don't have an exact occupation of the flow k bands, they deviate. So what one finds is that if it's high frequency, then the deviation is not so bad. It's like you get 80% of the maximum value. But the resonant case, you find that while the number would be 3 e squared over h, it seems to be hovering around 1 e squared over h. And again, that's not surprising given the edge state structure that I just explained to you. That, you know, in this particular phase, you have 3 edge modes, but two of them are arising due to resonant processes. And they're already occupied at such a high effective temperature that they do not contribute much to the transport. But anyway, so this is a little bit rushed because I wanted to come to the main topic, which is looking at entanglement. And I want to give an idea about how one can look at the entanglement spectrum, both of the exact wave function of the flow k Hamiltonian, which I'll call the flow k ground state, and the entanglement spectrum of the true state, which is obtained from unitary evolving it from some initial state, and get some idea about topological protection of all these edge states. Because they're all kinds of edge states, those sitting at the center, those sitting at the boundaries, and it's not clear that all of them are equally robust once you put in things like disorder. Okay. So how do we study the entanglement entanglement in the system? So we take a semi-infinite strip like this one, put periodic boundary conditions in the y direction, and the strip with the break translation invariance along the x direction, and because this is a free system, we use this result which was discussed by Peschel and Eisler, namely that because Wick's theorem holds, if I know the eigenvalues of my two-point correlation function in this subregion B, then from that I can construct the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. And from that I can construct the entanglement spectrum, the entanglement entropy and everything. So let's look at the correlation matrix within the strip B. Right? So this correlation matrix, I just have to solve this kind of an eigenvalue equation involving this matrix. CRR prime, eigenfunction phi r prime is eigenvalue epsilon times phi of r prime. Now, if I hadn't made this cut, right, if this was really an infinite system, then the eigenvalues of C is trivial. They're just the occupation probabilities, right? If I don't make any cut anywhere, I can just go into Fourier space, and that's just the occupation of the flow k bands. So if I'm in the flow k ground state, right, which is the exact eigenstate of the flow k Hamiltonian, and I'm at half filling, then that eigenvalue just takes two values, 0 for the conduction band and 1 for the valence band. But if I now put boundaries, right, any deviation from 0 and 1 in this ideal case will arise because I may have some additional edge modes that sit at the boundary. So remember this picture, because that explains what I'll show in the next slide. Namely, this is the entanglement spectrum as a function of ky, the momentum along the translationally invariant direction. You find that the entanglement spectrum are all clustered around two values, 0 and 1, which are just corresponding to the occupation of the occupied valence band and the empty conduction bands. But in addition, you see these chiral edge modes that are appearing in the system. They are typical topological edge modes in that they come out from one band and smoothly connect to the other band, and the only way to get rid of them is by closing the gap. And you'll see two kinds of colors here. Flow K refers to the entanglement spectrum of the exact eigenstate of the Flow K Hamiltonian, while Quench refers to the entanglement spectrum of the true state obtained from doing unitary time evolution. Okay? And this is an off-resonant laser, so you will find that they agree very well. There isn't much difference. So the golden line, golden crosses from the true time evolution exactly overlap with the blue circles. That's why you don't see them. The only deviation you see are like these things here. And these things actually occur at the K and K prime points of graphene. So because it was initially there was no gap, therefore, you know, when you do the quench, you always end up creating some residual excitation, bulk excitations, at the K and K prime point. And it is precisely those bulk excitations that are showing up here. So there is some slight closing of the entanglement gap, but they're happening at only some very special points in the Brillouin zone. Okay? So any questions about this? This is a simple part. Okay. If not, well, if you are more familiar with the picture for the entanglement entropy, you can calculate the entanglement entropy very simply when you have all the epsilon. You plug it into this expression, and so again, what I've done here is I've compared the entanglement entropy, how it scales, with the strip width. For the flow K state, which is the exact eigenstate of the final Hamiltonian, albeit time evolving, and the quench. And the quench is evolving in time, and so this result is obtained at very long times when the strip is inside the light cone. So everything has dephased, and if you like, the answers are very nicely given by the so-called diagonal ensemble. So what one finds is that the exact eigenstate of the Flow K Hamiltonian shows area loss scaling, as you would expect, because it's a short-range Hamiltonian with a huge gap. And so they all correspond to these lines which do not vary with strip width, because this is a quasi-1D system. Right? But all the ones that are varying linearly with strip width are the quench case. So the quench case, as you expect, shows volume loss scaling of the entanglement entropy. That's because, you know, you always create some ballistically propagating excitations, and so that'll end up giving you a volume law scaling with the prefactor of the volume law proportional to the density of excitations you've created. So not surprisingly, this high-frequency laser has the smallest slope because you've created the smallest density of bulk excitations. And then by the time I'm going up here, the laser is becoming more resonant. I'm creating more bulk excitations. And so the entanglement scaling is, the prefactor is larger. Yes? I didn't, but that's probably because it's trivial. It's trivial because it's a free fermion system. So it has to be given by the occupation probability of these flow K things. Yeah, it's just free fermion, so it has to follow the GGA. Okay. You don't even have to do any fancy high frequency type. Oh, okay, you mean do some fancy high frequency and then truncate it? I don't know. Oh, okay. I didn't think it was worth it anyway. So now comes the slightly more subtle part. Because what I showed you is that if I have a high frequency laser, well, even if I'm doing something violent to the system, there, like a quench, it's not so bad. Your conductivity is 80% of the maximum value. You look at the entanglement spectrum, and you find eigenstates in the entanglement spectrum that mimic those of the ground state of the Flow K Hamiltonian. There are some points in which the entanglement gap closes, but there are only a few points, and they are related to the K and K prime points of graphene. But the thing becomes more interesting in my when you have this slightly resonant laser. So this is the laser where you've created a topological phase transition and changed the Chern number to 3. And so if I had a physical boundary, remember, this is the one where the edge states are such that one goes one way and two go in the opposite direction. And the reason why they go one way and the two in the opposite direction is because you remember that that two of them are appearing on the top of the Floki bands, and one of them is in the center of the two Floki bands. So what is the signature of these three very strange edge states in the entanglement spectrum? So question one is, let's look at the eigenstates of the Floki Hamiltonian and see what are the signatures of these three edge modes in the eigenstates in the entanglement spectrum. And then the question two is, how does it look in the true state, which is obtained from doing unitary time evolution? Okay, so the two questions. So one of them is answered right here if I look at the blue circles. So the blue circles are really the ground state of the Floki Hamiltonian. All the eigenstates are at 0 and 1 because, again, we have a half-filled ideal system. And you do have three chiral edge modes. They correspond to this one, so the reason why this one is on the left edge and this one is on the right edge. Then you have this one and you have these ones. But in the entanglement spectrum, there's no such thing as above the band and below the band because particle number is conserved, right? The reason why you could have this strange arrangement here is because energy was not conserved. But here, particle number is conserved. So it turns out that the Floki eigenstate conserves the Chern number at 3, but the chirality of these edge states have to change to give you a Chern number of 3. So now these are like regular chiral edge states all propagating in the same direction in the entanglement spectrum. But the Chern number is conserved. Is that fine? So while here two were going this way, one was going this way, here all the three are going in the same direction if I look at it. So these are the three edge states, and they're all moving in one direction. And then if I look at the other end of the entanglement script, these are moving in the opposite direction. Okay. So the Chern number is what the wave function respects, and therefore the chirality has to change so as to preserve that Chern number. But what about the true state? So the true states are the golden lines, and indeed what you find is that one of the pair of edge states survive, and they are like the ones for the high-frequency laser. They appear right below the blue circles. And therefore, you don't see them explicitly. But the interesting thing is that these other edge states do not appear. They just simply don't appear in the entanglement spectrum. And what you're seeing instead out here are just the bulk states. And by just staring at the entanglement spectrum, you may not be able to guess that. You obviously have to look at how the wave function looks. And so these are how the eigenstates look. So this very solidly localized eigenstates on the entanglement strip correspond to these chiral edge modes, whereas this highly delocalized, these are bulk states, right, because they're all uniform occupation probability all throughout the strip width. And this is just clearly showing you that this is in the Floki state, and these are gone in the quench. And you might say, well, they're gone in the quench because maybe there is some very subtle overlap issues out here, where this initial state simply doesn't have good overlap with the final Hamiltonian. But that's not the case, because you can always do a slow switch on of the laser, and you'll still find that this physics holds, which is what we did here. So this is for a slow switch on, and you'll still find that the central edge mode always appears, but the side edge modes don't. And so the reason why that happens here is that even if the edge mode was originally present, it is living at the same. It has the same. It is coexisting with bulk states. So it hybridizes with the bulk states and just simply go away. So that's really the reason why. And and why does this not happen generically? It's because here is a plot to show you that the reason why it doesn't happen generically is because in this case I'm considering a very clean system where there's no disorder. So here is another case where it's a highly resonant laser, but you still had Chern number one, which corresponds to a set of chiral edge modes at the center of the Floki-Brillouin zone. And they also appear in the state which is unitary evolved from the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. But if I want to ask why I see them here and I don't see them here, is because in this case, the bulk states are sitting at a different momentum. So if there was disorder in the system, then even this edge state would end up scattering off of that bulk state and disappearing. Yes?
When you say entanglement spectrum, I might have missed it. It's entanglement spectrum after a long time?
Yeah, it's a long, everything I'm sure. Oh, yeah, so we wait, okay, so we wait very long times so that the system is inside the light cone. And then, so this is done, this is a particular snapshot because the system is still periodically evolving. So this is a particular snapshot. And you can ask what happens if I look at a slightly different time within the period of the laser. You mean stroboscopic evolution from the very beginning? Sorry, I don't understand.
But you just first time average, like entropy, for example.
Yeah.
Because if observables time average and take an expectation value computes for nonlinear functions, density matrix is not computed.
Uh huh, yeah.
So entropy of time average density matrix is not the same as time average, snapshot average.
Right. Yeah, so, but let me tell you that what we did here. So we just evolved the wave function, right? And it's and then we waited very long times so that the system was really inside the light cone. And so, and then we look at it at a given time. If you look at it slightly different time, that's also important to point out. What will happen is that this center will oscillate back and forth. But the churn number will be in such a way that the churn number is preserved. So that's the thing. But this picture is to just show you how to understand the topological protection of these edge modes. Because here I've considered a very clean system, and I've also considered a very uniform cut. So that is why these edge modes in the entanglement spectrum of the true state are surviving. But you can see that they are precariously located with respect to these bulk excitations. So if I have some disorder with sufficient matrix elements to couple these states, then even those would go away. In the previous example, it was just hitting us in the face because even without disorder, these edge modes were sitting at the same momenta as bulk states, so they were just hybridizing right away, and so they were gone. And but in this case, they're there only because we've done this, looking at this very uniform system. And then this is the case where the churn number is zero, and you have four edge modes. So here I would like to point out that even the entanglement spectrum of the grounds of the Floquet wave function has some interesting properties. So churn number zero means that you can have zero in many ways. Either you have no edge states, or you have like 10 edge states where five are going clockwise and other five are going anticlockwise, right? So this is an example where if I look at the Floquet wave function, at t equal to zero, Floquet eigenstate, then at t equal to zero, you do have some edge states. And this is the chirality of the edge states are canceling chiralities, which ensures that the total churn number is zero. But these edge states go away when you look at it at a certain other time. So they might come and go, but in a periodic fashion. When you look at the entanglement spectrum for the true state obtained from unitary evolving the system, these are the golden lines, and you can see that at these laser frequencies I'm considering, and because I'm at half filling, you've completely closed the entanglement gap, and as a result of that, you basically don't see any edge states in the true states, true system, because they've all ended up hybridizing with the bulk states with which they they appear at the same momentum ky. So to cut a long story short, the main take-home message from the entanglement spectrum of the churn insulator is that if you look at the chirality of the edge states of the true wave function, they have to rearrange themselves in such a way to mimic the churn number of the Hamiltonian. And moreover, if you look at the entanglement spectrum of the true wave function, then it can give you a very good idea about which of these edge states are topologically protected and which of these are not. So, for example, in this picture, you can argue that the edge states that were arising due to off-resonant processes, because they are sufficiently separated from bulk excitations, have better topological protections than the additional two edge states that were arising due to resonant processes. So, and it's also consistent with the results we obtained for the DC conductivity, where that particular phase continued to show a conductivity which was order 1 E squared over H. Okay, so now let me shift gears, and how much time? Oh, it's finished? Ah, okay. So, since I have no time left, I encourage you, those of you who are interested, to come and talk to me, because in the example I gave you, there was no interactions, but there are interactions in the second half, where we just look at this large N limit of this 5-4 theory quench. And we quench to a critical point, and as is typical of critical points, correlation functions show some interesting universal behavior with new exponents. And we were trying to find out the signature of these exponents in the entanglement entropy and entanglement spectrum. And so come and discuss with me if you are interested. So with that, I'll just put up the slides. Okay.
So for the resonant edge modes, did you ever try ramping instead of amplitude, ramping frequency down from high to low?
No, we didn't do that. We always were doing the amplitude quench. And so then the problem that happens is that if you do the amplitude, it turns out that there is no true adiabatic limit in that case, because there's always some instant of time when the quasi-energies become vanishingly small. And then in that particular case, it's not probably a good idea to do a slow ramp. It's better to do a fast ramp. Because then what happens is that if you do it really fast, then for most of the time, the system actually doesn't have the time to absorb energy from the laser that much. If you do it too slowly, because when you apply a laser, it does two things. One of the things it does is that it also modifies the effective band gap. So if the amplitude is too small, right, then the resonant condition is obeyed for a longer period of time. Whereas if the amplitude becomes very large very quickly, then it can flatten up the bands and make the system, again, effectively off-resonant. So sometimes doing it fast suppresses excitations. Yeah. Well, I mean, it was okay. Well, I would say that it was a conceptually easier way for us to visualize the effect of disorder, right? So, I mean, this tells you right away in the entanglement spectrum that the gap is closing in the entanglement spectrum. It's an alternate way of looking at the topological protection of these edge states. Because you can put it in the language of whether the true gap of the system closes or not. Now you can ask, does the entanglement gap close or not? Does it close only in some special points, or does it close in large arcs? And so you can kind of give the language in terms of, it's better to think in this language whether your topological edge modes are protected or not. That's one way to see it. I mean, you could have looked at it the other way, but somehow I think it's easier to see it in this picture. Because you can see right away that you have these edge states, but at some distance away, you really just close the entanglement gap here. So this is really not a very robust state, because if I put a disorder of this particular magnitude, it'll end up hybridizing with those states and go away. Yeah.
So what do you expect to happen qualitatively if you include energy relaxation?
Sorry?
So if you included energy relaxation, so what would you expect to happen? I mean, is there some simple regime, like high frequency, low frequency?
Yeah, well, high frequency is going to be trivial in the sense that, you know, when you couple them to phonons of the right energy, you'll be able to get rid of even these excitations, effectively cool the system and get rid of even these excitations. But if I go to the resonant case, then it's not so obvious, right? Because what can happen is that the resonant case is one where the laser is photo-exciting carriers and you couple it to a reservoir and it'll cool it, but then the laser will again excite it. And so you have to work out the steady state distribution. And you'll end up getting some spectrum which may be qualitatively different from it, but it depends on the details of the coupling to the reservoir. But in principle, even for the open system, you can recast the entanglement spectrum. Look at the entanglement spectrum again at the steady state. That's not, And I mean, we did study the distribution function when coupled, but we didn't look at the corresponding entanglement spectrum. But for the free system, you can guess what it would be like because it's all being constructed from the occupation probabilities.